Everyone, welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America and worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay with us for tonight's special report on the underground history of American education right after this message. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. And while his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer, made in Taiwan, to work and then shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. Then Joe puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan, his designer jeans made in Singapore, a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea, and after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator, made in Mexico, how much money can he spend today? Well, after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany. He goes looking for a job that's like he has been for several months. At the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV, made in Japan, and then ponders again why it is that he can't find a good-paying American job. Well, you know, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? I know that's a wild new concept. But if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative and obtaining. It's educational, and it's free of charge. And you can call right now and order yours. It's 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my website, georgegordon.org. Now, click onto the email machine and send me an email request for your general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, let's take a look at the Money Changer. The Money Changer is published by Franklin Sanders. We'll give him a plug here. Post Office Box 178, West Point, Tennessee, 38486. If you don't subscribe to the Money Changer, then you're missing a powerful newsletter. It comes out monthly. It comes in here. Of course, we subscribe to a whole host and plethora of newsletters, news magazines, newspapers to stay abreast of what's going on in the world. And of all the newsletters that come in here, there's two that I value the most, and that's the Money Changer and the Privateer. Those are the two top money letters or money newsletters that I know of in the world today. The Money Changer, again, is Franklin Sanders, Post Office Box 178, West Point, Tennessee, 38486. Got a couple of telephone numbers here. You can call 931-766-6066, or you can call 888-218-9226. Let's try that again. Telephone number number one is 931-766-6066, or 888-218-9226. This is a Money Changer interview with John Taylor Gatto. It's the underground history of American education. Gatto is a historian and an educator. Well, John Taylor Gatto was born in Monongahela, Pennsylvania, river town, where his grandfather was the town printer. He attended public schools and a private Catholic boarding school. As a boy, he worked as a sweeper in his grandfather's printing office, snow shoveling, lawnmower, Kool-Aid and comic book salesman, and delivery boy for the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph and the Uniontown Morning Herald. Among other jobs, after undergraduate work at Cornell, the University of Pittsburgh, and Columbia University, he served in the U.S. Army Medical Corps. Later, he did graduate work at the City University of New York, Hunter College, Yeshiva, and the University of California, and Cornell. He has credentials. After college, Mr. Gatto worked as a film scriptwriter, an advertising writer, a taxi driver, a jeweler, designer, an ASCAP songwriter, and a hot dog vendor before becoming a schoolteacher. Now, during his school teaching career, he also entered the caviar trade. He conducted an antique business, operated a rare book search service, and founded Lava Mountain Records, a documentary record producer. And he climaxed his teaching career as New York State Teacher of the Year after being named New York City Teacher of the Year three times. In a 1991 letter to the Wall Street Journal, he resigned while still New York State Teacher of the Year, claiming that he was no longer willing to hurt children. Later that year, he was the subject of a Carnegie Hall presentation, which launched a career of public speaking about school reform. That has taken him over 1.5 miles in all 50 states and 7 foreign countries. His books include Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, The Exhausted School, A Different Kind of Teacher, and The Underground History of American Education. For 40 years, Mr. Gatto has been married to the same woman and has two grown children and a cat. After reading Mr. Gatto's latest book, The Underground History of American Education, I asked him for this interview, and I recommend the book to every person in America. You can order a copy for $36 postpaid, priority mail from John Taylor Gatto, 235 West 76th Street, New York, New York, 10023. His website is www.johntaylorgatto.com. I'll give you that again. John Taylor Gatto, 235 West 76th Street, New York, New York, 10023. His website is www.johntaylorgatto.com. Money Changer asks the first question. He said, a friend gave me your book and audio tape, and you did a magnificent job, not only from the standpoint of the objective history, but also for what you revealed about the subjective change that schooling works in us. It cultivates obsequiousness and flattery in a child and creates a truckling a person while it replaces real education with studying things that really don't matter. The tragedy is taking children who probably would be very intelligent, productive members of society and teaching them nothing but how to pass tests. They get out into the world and they find that they don't know anything and aren't good for anything and can't succeed. Well, Gatto's response was, about 10 years ago, the country's highest rate of suicide for a coherent group was the group that won the National Merit Scholarships. Money Changer. For those of us trying to understand modern American society and how we got here from where we were, and then how can we escape, you've written as a kind of unified field theory that explains everything centered on public education. What happened? How did America change from a nation of free people, entrepreneurs, and small freeholders with their own judgment and educated people into a nation of employees? Gatto responds, well, several overwhelming historical trends have collided. After we won the American Revolution and passed through the decades they call the Federal Period, it became fairly clear that the theory of social layering wasn't nearly as valid as many people would have liked. And I base that in part on Alexis de Tocqueville's Reflections in Democracy in America. Money Changer. Well, what do you mean social layering? Gatto. Well, coming from the French aristocracy and very curious about the United States, de Tocqueville was impressed simultaneously by the energy and intellect of ordinary people. Historically, those had been assumed to be impossible. He also was repelled by their vulgarity. But ordinary people without a government boot on their neck were able to do just about anything. And while that struck Mr. de Tocqueville as a wonderful thing overall, it struck a great many other people as not at all wonderful. Recall that during the American Revolution, very large numbers of Americans were horrified by the vulgar classes asserting themselves. Money Changer. You mean people like Alexander Hamilton? Gatto. Yes. But there were many others. The rising capitalist class in the United States was particularly appalled. For example, the famous Boston Peabody family. They were underwriting railroad construction to the coal mines in what was then the West. They could foresee that an industrial utopia arising from the enormous U.S. coal reserves by the century's end, and I may be a little confusing here as I jump around historically, the United States was known to possess twice the coal reserves of all the rest of the world combined, plus oil, twice as efficient as coal, had also come online by the 1860s and 70s. Money Changer. Are you talking about 1820 to 1860? Gatto, yes, for coal, for oil a little later. That period witnesses a reaction against the American Revolution and ordinary people of Benjamin Franklin's type. They were inserting themselves into leadership positions, and for the class-based English or German mind, that was acting out of type. It was totally unacceptable. Money Changer. So we saw the political tussle between the aristocracy of the Northeast and the Bank of the United States on the one side, and these upstart Andrew Jackson followers, the common people, on the other. Gatto, yes, that's a very clear example. Jackson, in particular, horrified the established classes. They began feeling that their position was somewhat tenuous. But at the same time, some far-sighted men saw that a source of dependable energy like coal would portend, never mind oil, because it just enhances the potential. All of the toys of history, the little mechanical things that delighted kings and emperors, suddenly could be hooked to a dependable power source. Prior energy sources like wind, water, wood, and animals were all quite efficient. But now the prospect of freeing people, manufacturing, and management from inordinate dependence on labor made itself, if not evident, at least it was discussed in drawing rooms, tantalizingly right at hand. Then genuinely brilliant men like Carnegie and Rockefeller saw that the efficiency made possible by this new energy source could be combined with a social efficiency that had never been achieved before. And how? Well, through forced universal education. And I hasten to excuse myself from agitating class warfare here, but these men genuinely believed that they were leading humanity into the millennium, Sure, they would have to break a few eggs along the way, but in the end, everyone would benefit. The money changer. It was sort of a noblesse oblige that obliged the smart and the rich to determine the destiny of the stupid and the poor. In one of his speeches, Carnegie called it something like the burden of the rich. It's a sort of twisted vision of the theological doctrine of predestination. I'm rich because God or destiny or evolution has made me the best. Since I am the best, I must tip my hat to heaven and now get busy reorganizing human society around myself. Gatto, you're right. But we must be careful not to categorize these people too cleanly because they often drift back and forth. Carnegie came from very humble beginnings, bootstrapping himself without the benefit of an education. Schooling is a civil religion, and at its beginnings was known as that openly. In a society without an established religion like Germany's and Great Britain's, schooling became our substitute. It still serves that function today, although it's in an advanced state of disarray. Like Humpty Dumpty, I'm not sure that it's possible to pull American education back together again. Even the people who profit from education in America are deeply disaffected. And I'm rather old and old-fashioned, but still the degree of cynicism among those who profit from schooling appalls me. Now, other large groups of society view education with implacable hatred and anger, but then it couldn't be reformed without making it something else entirely, because schooling performs brilliantly the function that schooling has been established to perform. You see, schooling creates the conscious indispensable for a mass production economy. Now, the money changer comes back and says, in other words, a mass production economy must have mass men to achieve mass consumption. Gatto, you absolutely cannot have anything other than massified man and massified woman. No one will gamble the huge amounts of money to tool up for this or that unless they're pretty sure that they can be guaranteed a profit. Now, in the 20th century, government has made those guarantees when market research crystal balls gazing is hazy. And we wouldn't have a computer industry if the Defense Department had not absolutely guaranteed hundreds of businesses, which ultimately failed, that it wouldn't matter if they succeeded or failed, that they would be paid. Now, over a relatively short period of time, a couple of decades, enough of them have succeeded to give us a head start in world technology. But without the Defense Department's money, that wouldn't have happened. At least, it wouldn't have happened the way it did. But it reaches much further than the Defense Department. My wife was the treasurer of a New York City school board. Because of her husband's prior character, I got to see all of the papers that had passed through that school board that stretched from the Upper West Side of Manhattan between Columbia University and Lincoln Center. It spends about $12,000 a year on each and every child in that school district, though you'd need to be a detective or a school board treasurer to track the revenue stream. That's how cleverly the money is hidden. It became instantly clear to me that public education was a relaying mechanism to distribute contracts and to supply employment. What the average parent in the district thought schooling's purpose was hardly entered the school board's deliberations. School boards are not there to discuss education. They're there to discuss budgets. They were busy putting their hand, or this hand and that hand, taking orders from this party or that party. At first, I thought, well, it's only this school district that's doing it. But by assiduously gathering countrywide data over a period of years, I've now come to see that it was the standard pattern everywhere in America. The talk about what the kids needed was just superficial frosting, and quickly, it's been done away with. Money changer. The real point was, who was going to get the contracts? Is that right? Gatto. That's right. That was the real point. But also in big city America, it's very, very useful to be able to turn out children for this or that purpose. It's kind of like a dual-purpose system. It puts out money for contracts to stimulate the economy. And at the same time, we can train the children that are in the institution, now that they've been institutionalized, to be consumers, to be producers for corporate America. And in the liaisons between corporate business and government, to be able to display a certain interest in the well-being of the children is one of the guaranteed ways to fasten on to the money stream, the money express. Money changer. So public education is in reality a gigantic public works project. Gatto. Yes, and probably the largest public works project in the history of man. Money changer. Well, in Memphis, Tennessee, where Federal Express and I don't know how many other big corporations are headquartered, who is the country's largest employer? Gatto. Well, I can guess. Money changer. Well, it's the school system. Every state devotes 40% or more of its budget to education. Never mind that education and the need for more education and education funding are still used as an excuse for installing lotteries, which they've just done here in Tennessee. Now imagine how much money public education consumes. It is a gigantic public works project, expending huge amounts of money to soak up otherwise excess production and to employ millions otherwise unemployed people, or who would be unemployable. Gatto. Well, probably 3 to 4 million directly, but a great many others in the ancillary industries, such as publishing, food preparation, desk building, truck driving. It's absolutely the largest employer, and I think it's set up to be elastic. When jobs run short nationally, schools suddenly find a reason to employ paraprofessionals. They expand employment to lessen the revolutionary potential of too many unemployed. This New York City school board rubber stamped whatever the superintendent asked for, and I was curious about that. When my wife got on the school board, we didn't know anything about the politics, and certainly she didn't run for the board to learn about the politics of public education. But we soon saw that all of the other members on the school board were annoyed that a teacher's wife had been elected. You see, all of the other members were in one way or another politically ambitious, and this was a career stage for them. There was always someone on the school board who represented the real estate industry, and obviously they didn't announce that, but that is what they represented. Then there was always somebody who represented the major industry in town. In some towns in the Northwest, it's the timber industry. Or if it's in a town like Berkeley, California, it's academia. The smaller the town, the clearer that linkage becomes. The school board had been corrupted, or suborned is the legal term, fairly early on by small payoffs, and it became a relay for careers rather than representing the people. Now back to our historical discussion. In that period, up to the war for Southern independence, they began to restore the English order. Is that class structure? Gatto responds, yes, it is, but not out of motives the Marxists might ascribe. You see, from a religious viewpoint, they were ordering society the way God wanted it. But from a secular standpoint, a Darwinian viewpoint, these were the evolutionary advance securing their improvements. There are any number of ways to arrive at the same conclusion. Now, the war for Southern independence removed the principal obstacle in the new social engine's path, a different way to think about what's valuable and what is not valuable. So from the end of the Civil War in 1865 until the 1890s, these ideologues were absolutely in the driver's seat. They made heavy use of Darwin's second major book, The Descent of Man. Darwin said that if the evolutionary retarded, who make up 95% of the population, crossbred with the good stuff, evolution would march backwards. Disgusted shockwaves ran through drawing rooms in Boston and New York, and probably in London and Paris and Berlin also. Money changer. Now, that spawned the eugenics movement that culminates in monsters like Margaret Sanger, who founded Planned Parenthood. The population control movement has both an ideological and an economic function. Ideological because they think the gene pool has to be cleansed, and they're the ones who rightly own the chlorine and ought to be using it. Economic because too many people can destabilize the mass production, mass consumption society. Too many people cannot be employed, so employers grind down wage rates and the system creates a proletarian underclass, always threatening to rise up and overthrow the system. And by the way, what I have just laid out is not a Marxist critique, Gatto. Well, I understand that it's a kind of a loyalist critique. Money changer. Well, my guess is that the elite in big business and government really believe that. That was my point to you in my letter about George Fitzhugh's book, Cannibals All, published in 1852. Fitzhugh's theories and theorizes that the end of slavery or serfdom inevitably creates an overpopulation problem. Too many workers, not enough work. Then because capital is so much stronger than labor, employers will always bid wages down to a starvation level, and the starving will underbid each other for any work. That, in turn, marginalizes large numbers of people to starvation's edge, creating an underclass that continuously threatens revolution. Fitzhugh's case was strong, and the industrializing European states, especially England, yielded abundant current evidence to support that. I was also trying to point out that Harvard's Belknap Press keeps Fitzhugh's book in publication. And why is that? Well, why would the elite interest themselves in keeping in print an apologist for slavery? And I'm convinced they do it because the same elite who engineered public education really believe that Fitzhugh is correct. And they believe that he described a sort of natural law that threatens the whole setup of modern society. Now, I believe Fitzhugh's theory lies behind the creation of the welfare state to reduce and control this potential revolution and the economy, and all of the host of automatic stabilizers that are built in to control the economy, from the 1948 Full Employment Act to highway construction to abortion to public education, which not only dumbs down the proletariat but delays their entering the workforce. Gatto, well, I see that this is one of the sacred texts, and I'm certain that you're right in a larger sense, namely that certain sacred texts are kept in print to train the next generation of managers. The omnipresence of Plato's Republic always intrigues me. The money changer. Well, Plato first justified the idea of a ruling elite, philosopher kings, benevolently controlling the idiotic underclass. As the most respectable figure to enunciate their ideology, it's only logical that they would keep going back to him, now isn't it? Gatto. Now, notice this. Whenever a period of uncontrolled history opens up, like the war between the states or between the colonial America and the war for southern independence, it produces evidence to challenge this upper class underclass relationship, which brings out a real problem for social engineers to solve. If the blasted underclasses are determined to demonstrate that they don't belong in the category where fate and the elite have put them, then something has to be done to make them get into the box and stay there. Money changer. And that something is what? Gatto. Public school. Of course, the healthy share of private schools allow the public school model too, and they follow the public schools, and they get their textbooks from the public schools. They operate more cosmetically because they're smaller and drawn from a more genteel class of customer. Now, I am not including in that charge any of the elite private boarding schools, only the ones that fall outside the two or three inner circles. It's odd that the last two presidential elections should have caused an inquiry from the American Journalist Fraternity. Bush is from a top 10 boarding school and Kerry is from a top 10 boarding school. In the last election, Al Gore was from a top 10 elite boarding school, and the number of the secondary candidates like John McCain, the great champion of the people, also comes from an elite top 10 boarding school, and in his case, so elite that most people have never even heard of it. A large number of these elite school graduates show up in the national leadership, like Franklin Roosevelt from Groton and John F. Kennedy from Choate. Now, I spent a couple of years digging into the inner circle, and there are 20 of that class, perhaps another 250 to 300 that imitate these schools and the outer darkness for everyone else. What do these schools specialize in? Well, after a considerable labor, I was able to list 10 of the 12 qualities that these schools aimed at. Immediately, I saw the distinction between the best public schools and these private boarding schools and how they train managerial cadre. Not in colleges, but in secondary schools, they're often given their outlook and certain skills that are absolutely unavailable to public school children. Not unavailable legally, they simply don't make schooling packed curriculum. If a kid's parents don't make up the lack, it's not likely to be made up at all. If it's not made up before the age of 18, it's hard to make up at any point in that child's life from that point on. And we got to take a quick break here. We're looking at an interview from the Money Chamber, or Money Changer, get that right, with John Taylor Gatto, the underground history of American education. We'll be back right after this quick break. You have been listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, sponsored by the Gordon Law School, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property, and public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. Permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, zoning and planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do. And the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. Remember, it's educational, entertaining, informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can order your free copy right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and request your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about an interview with the Money Changer and John Gatto. Gatto is a public school teacher from New York City, teacher of the year, many credentials, many books. He has turned against public school education. Why has he done that? Because it's a brainwashing program, a public works program, which is not designed to teach or train your children. Anything that's intelligent for your children to learn, it's there to teach your children to be followers, consumers, and employees of corporate business. Now, the money changer goes on and says, well, what characteristic, or as Gatto interjects, he says, the most common is called public speaking. That fussy term makes us think of someone making a graduation speech, but basically it's the ability to swim in any sort of citizen pool, to be able to put together a compelling argument and to deliver that argument without biting your fingernails or sweating. Now, in 30 years of public school teaching, I discovered something to my satisfaction. If your English class, and I taught English, if your English class specialized in public speaking in a relatively short time, 3 or 4 months, you'd get at least competency out of virtually everybody, including kids who never ate off of a tablecloth in their lives. Now, I could only extrapolate what would happen if the curriculum emphasized it for 12 years and all of the children of America were aware of why public speaking was so important. And this will tickle you. In my historical reading, I discovered that in colonial Virginia and a number of other states, it was a crime to teach ordinary people the tricks of public speaking. There are introverts and extroverts. The extroverts are the leaders. The extroverts are the public speakers. The introverts are the followers. Money changer. What? I can't believe that. Gatto, yes. Public speaking and writing are called the active literacies. They allow an individual to enlist followers. That's dangerous. You cannot do that. You cannot be allowed too many public speakers. You cannot have too many leaders. Now, the other chief distinction between the public schools and the elite private schools is writing. Not only is public speaking taught in the elite schools, but writing is taught there. But public speaking and writing are not taught in public school. There, too, I proved to my own satisfaction that even relative idiots can learn how to do short pieces of coherent, cogent writing. Practice over and over again, and it just happens. It just appears, and once it happens, it never unhappens. It never goes away. Education is dangerous. Education must be kept away from public school students at all costs. They would learn to be leaders instead of followers. We cannot have that in a corporate society. Money changer. Now, the students who learned these skills, public speaking and writing, were not from New York's upper class, were they? Gatto, no. They were kids from Harlem and Spanish Harlem, which are close geographically, but worlds apart socially. It wasn't even very hard to do, so I don't pat myself on the back. You just have to make it a priority, that's all. Now, after you penetrate those children's or those kids' shell of hostility, after 90 days of sincerity, they take to it like a duck to water because they're naturally more intensely social than other kids. Now, I spent 5 years with New York's Upper West Side elite at the very beginning of my teaching career. Then the school district tried to shake me loose by moving me from school to school, so I ended up by my mid-career in Harlem and Spanish Harlem. Their resistance was all superficial. They love having the power that anyone can master if he will go through the exercise. It's like lifting weights. If you lift weights often enough, you'll have a firm muscle. Speaking isn't any different. Once you learn public speaking, it's like having strong muscles. Now, I give 3 bottles of Irish whiskey to the custodian, and he supplied me with a master key in an empty room with a schedule, and that way I always knew where I could pop the kids to do these exercises. It wasn't very hard to do, and by the end of a single school year, they showed a wide band of competence and a couple who already showed flashes that they could be outstanding. And I could only guess what would happen if the system made this a priority. Can you imagine what would happen to black, Puerto Rican, and Spanish-speaking children who could read, write, and speak? My God, it would create a revolution. Certainly, we would have a much different social and economic system if this were done nationwide. We can't have that in America. Now, as far as I can read America's economic layers, the easiest way for a nobody to move quickly into business success is through sales. Obviously, if you can't put yourself in the other fellow's mind, which drama teaches, and stroke the other person's fears or ambitions, which literature and some other studies teach, you can't sell very well, can you? So our standard school curriculum deliberately excludes a huge number of people from learning this very easily attainable skill, public speaking and writing. Why? They were meant to be the drawers of water and the hewers of wood, not the leaders of society. The money changer. Most people would regard the children you taught as the hopelessly worthless scum of society, and they probably looked like it too. Were they just as belligerent and unpleasant as they could be when you first got them? Gatto. Yes, they were. Money changer. But you taught these students, blacks, Puerto Ricans, Hispanics, you taught them public speaking and writing? Then it is not inevitable that these people have to live out their lives as useless slaves of corporate America? You mean that means, John, that modern society in its present structure is not inevitable? Gatto. Not at all. And for that, I wouldn't demonize the managerial classes as the left likes to do. The blame lies more with a marked lack of imagination of what kind of economy we could have if everyone in our society was competent. Money changer. Well, picking back up our thread of history before the war for Southern independence, big businessmen began to see the possibilities of a mass production, mass consumption society. Mass society. They began the cooperation of business and government in education, with business very much the senior partner. And they also needed public education to forestall potential competitors because they believed that overproduction is the nemesis that inescapably haunts mass society. Gatto. Yes, that was the fatal cancer of industrial capitalism. Money changer. Or as John D. Rockefeller put it, competition is a sin. Since potentially every child born might bring with him some new industry to displace what presently exists, someone must get to that kid before he affects the economic equation. It's the dumbing down of America. Gatto. Yes, and the easiest way to do that is to make sure that the overwhelming number can't rock any boat. Money changer. Well, by never awakening their mind to the fact that their mind is there. Carry this a step further. Every day people have so much latent ability that it would erupt if schooling didn't suppress it. What would society look like if all these people were freed from regulation, class stratification, and schooling classifications? Freed from these anchors that government and big business and public education tie around their necks. Gatto. Well, I've never found any satisfactory speculation in print because the Darwinian void weighs down all of the speculators. They believe that only a few can find ways to be useful, so all the rest have to truckle under. I travel constantly, and ever since, in a while, or every once in a while, I'll drive through a college town at night. The whole town will be blazing with lights, the streets will be full of people, and they'll be moving at some brisk rate because they have some undertaking underway. They inspire and cross-pollinate each other. I went to Cornell for a while, and Ithaca was a town very much like that. But I don't think we need a great university present to do that. That university lives in our flesh and blood, our spirit. It just must be allowed to express itself. In college, I read Democracy in America, and I had a particularly bad time with it. But when I read it again a few years ago, I could see that de Tocqueville had been dazzled by a world that he had never seen except at the court, at the king's court. And all of these bumpkins had a purpose, and they were on their way with a project. Money changer. Well, the general education level prevailing from the Revolutionary War to the War for Southern Independence amazes me. Now, I have a BA, several years of graduate school, studied in Germany for a year, and I'm a pretty well-educated person by today's standards. But for me to try to read Calhoun or Jefferson or John Taylor is a real labor. It's all I can do to stay awake. In a history of the DuPonts, I found that one of the early DuPonts had written back to France in 1808 that 98% of the American population was literate. Now, that's a far greater percentage of literacy than today. Those Americans, even farmers and mechanics, enjoyed a level of erudition, education, cultivation, aesthetic sensitivity, and elevation of character that's inconceivable even by today's standards, and we call ourselves a literate nation. Gatto. Well, the great flowering of folk art, too, was nipped in the bud when small farms were destroyed. You see, a lot of that was deliberate, although not in the Marxist sense. Not a bunch of bad guys sitting around the table with their collars turned up, planning to harm the others. Rather, the self-designated elite was aesthetically revolted by the different patterns of culture that these people were bringing. In addition, a lot of the younger people were caught up by the possibility of an organized religion in mass society. It was a unifier that delivered universal purpose and gave you a set of marching orders, something that had to be found to replace Christianity. And Darwin offered the progress of evolution to replace the progress of the soul. Evolution replaced Christianity. Money changer. We mistakenly view the Victorian age as an age of great faith, while in fact they were waiting for any excuse to abandon Christianity. Darwin's first book sold out in a few days and immediately passed through the English and Western intellectual world as Christianity's replacement. Well, Gatto replied, 12 years later, the descent of man justified walling off the good stock from the bad stock and making the bad stock police themselves. Mortimer Zuckerman, the publisher of U.S. News and World Report, wrote an article for Foreign Affairs magazine several years ago. I almost fell over when I read it. I couldn't believe that anyone would be that candid, but then who reads Foreign Affairs anyway? Zuckerman said that no one could catch the American economy for 100 years. And why? Well, because the American working man took such careful building. He now has such unusual characteristics that it would take a century to reproduce him elsewhere. Now, what are those unusual characteristics that we find in the American working man? Well, he defines himself by what he buys. So when he has nothing, if you extend credit to him, he'll mortgage himself and his children forever just to keep consuming. That is one strength of the American workman. The second, that he lives in constant fear of losing his job. Since he knows that he doesn't know how to do anything at all, he lives in constant fear, and that goes right up the line of management. He knows there are 20 or 30 or 50 people waiting for his job, and that makes him totally tractable and docile. If he loses his job, he may never get a job again. And it's this fear that motivates him, the money changer. And the older he gets, the less chance he has. Now, in a slightly different form, that is George Fitzhugh's argument in Cannonball's All. The elite, however, is clever enough not to allow conditions to get so bad that the underclass, in fact, starves to death. That's why we must have the welfare apparatus and the other built-in stabilizers installed since the New Deal. They prevent the system from destroying itself. Terror keeps American workers in line. It is terror of losing your job, literally losing your place in the world, losing the ability to do meaningful work, even though the work is not very meaningful, as we all know. He's terrified that he will be cast into limbo. For a man, it is the terror of being castrated. Yes, Gatto responds, well, that's priceless. Zuckerman in 1998 confirms what Fitzhugh wrote in 1854, and that is, that recently a wealthy man faxed me. He grew up in an Indianapolis working-class family in the 1960s, and he said his dad's ability to repair the house, build a garage, design and build several sailboats, and do all kinds of mechanical things led him to the ability to do the same thing through that to academic competence. Public education banishes children from the working world. Our best example of what good flows from not banishing them is Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. By age 12, Franklin is working a 60-hour week. He details the curriculum that he and his friends put themselves through in their spare time. I'll tell you, Yale wouldn't dream of asking undergraduates to do that kind of curriculum. Franklin came from a family of 16 kids, and kids were working a 60-hour work week. Money changer. Well, I noticed something when I moved out into the country. Farm kids have to pitch in. The Amish are the best example of that. Among the Amish around us, I have seen 5-year-old girls bringing up half a dozen big Holsteins to milk, or 12-year-old boys plowing behind 3 big Belgian horses. Even on modern farms, kids have to do everything. About 6 months living out here, it struck me that city-bred people can never even approach the level of competence and responsibility of the country raised. You see, if you live on a farm, you have to be able to make every mechanical repair yourself. And if you're not responsible for everything around you, nobody else will be. So these kids are not ruined. Far from it. They become great human beings, competent. Gatto. Well, one interesting secret that public education doesn't mention. About 20% of the highest incomes in the country belong to operatives, people who run heavy equipment or repair computers. Now, they're 1/5 of the top 1% of U.S. incomes in 30 years of school teaching. I never encountered that interesting fact, although I must say that from time to time I suspected it. Now, let me repeat that. Gatto said again, one interesting secret that public education never tells you about is this, and that is 20% of the highest incomes in the country belong to operatives, that is, people who run heavy equipment or repair computers. Now, boys and girls, those are called entrepreneurial or private businesses. Now, they may operate in the public sector, but those are the people that make the money. The money changer, well, what do you recommend for people with children in public schools? What can they do? If public education is so bad, what does a family with mama working and 2 or 4 children to do, or a lone father or mother? Well, Gatto. First, that family relationship has to be very active. The intellectual and character-building part of it can't be. What did you do in school today, and let me help you with your homework? As far as homeschooling, I have been screaming at one expert for 5 years that he owes it to us to write a book. Pat Ferenga, head of John Holt Associates up in Boston, ran a loose-knit association of 15,000 homeschoolers. I asked him about 10 years ago how a single mom, for example, homeschools, and he said that about 1/4 of his membership is in that position. Apparently, there are a lot of ways to do homeschooling with single mothers and single fathers, and probably it would be an art at all times. But the best of our lives are an art. And at the end of each school year, I would take all of my notes and throw them away because I found myself repeating what worked. There's nothing wrong with that, but I wasn't growing or experiencing any productive tension. I only do that by starting from scratch every year. Money changer. Any parent that engages in homeschooling finds that he learns as much as the child does. Gatto. Even if your child goes to a local public school, you have to homeschool and show that kid that education is something that you take. Nobody gives education to anybody. Mickey and David Colfax wrote a great book, called Trouble in Paradise. They homeschooled four sons in Northern California, and with all of the money that they had in the world, they bought a broken-down homestead on a mountaintop that didn't have a road into it. For the first year, they lived in a car while they cut a road into their homestead. For the first 10 years, they had to go a mile or further to draw water out of a valley and bring it up in buckets. The first three sons were each accepted into Harvard on full tuition scholarships. The fourth son became a nationally known goat breeder and said he didn't have time to waste on college. Colfax had been a college professor, but was blackballed for some reason. They knew nothing about homesteading when they started out. It's not only inspiring and funny, the book explored areas of growth that were never told exist. Well, if you try to follow a curriculum like public school, when you homeschool, you miss it. Gatto, well, you miss a lot. Homeschool is probably the best education that money can buy. Money changer. Well, you torture yourself because people don't learn that way. Rather, they get interested in Egyptology and they go read everything they can or everything they can find on Egyptology. The bottom line, boys and girls, in the last minute or two. Here's an educator who's been teaching in the public schools and says the public school sucks, and the bottom line is that it's designed to dumb your kid down. Now, if you want dumb children, send them to public school. You can't get a dumber kid than a child educated in public school, a child that can't think, a robot, an automaton, a brainwashed automaton who works for a corporation terrified that he's going to lose his job. And you've heard me say it time and time again, there's no money. There's no money in employment. And that's because the corporations control the employment. Now, if business controls the employment, they also control the wages. They control the wages through the labor unions. The corporations control the labor unions. The labor unions are Uncle Tom's. They say that, and they preach that, and they appear that they're representing the working man. They're not. The exporting of American employment, jobs, manufacturing jobs to countries around the world is proof positive that corporations control the unions. The unions should be striking. The unions should be voting for somebody else. They're not. They're in lockstep with the corporations. The corporations are in lockstep with the government, and the government's in lockstep with the unions and the corporations. And the public school system is a system that is designed to train workers to work in the system, in the society. Take what we give you and be grateful for it. I call that brainwashing. I've hit that a time or two here on the program. It's a decision, of course, that you have to make. Life is made up of choices and decisions, and that's why I suggest that you educate yourself. I'm a great champion of homeschool, and the law school is a home school. Why don't you write and ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it? Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Just ask for the free CD law package. All right, we're just about out of time. The Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, medicine, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Well, there's the signal. My time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow, God willing, same time, same station. So till then, good night, friends.